forgive them, Lord, they know not what they've done. Cause as sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share now. What's mine? And then the harder they come, the harder they fall. One and the ooh, the harder they come, harder they fall. One and the
good day, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ali Farkaturi you're listening to, and the Ali Farkaturi, this is the album Talking Timbuktu that came out with Rai Kooter, oh my goodness, 5-6 years ago. This is number 9 on that. It's Song Guy. Trust and faith in your fellow man has no equal. If you've experienced trust, you know its strength. You must know yourself before you know others. That's the amazing sound that some people said sounded like the African blues, and you can certainly hear the kind of rhythms and sounds that made that African context to the blues come alive in the United States centuries later. Ali died in March, and they're having a huge commemoration ceremony for him this coming March with all sorts of people. Peter Gabriel, they're all coming to Bamako to honor him. A man of the people who stayed in his country, who developed, he became mayor of his own town and died in his hometown, in his own village.
You're listening to ongoing special programming, La Rage du Peuple, kicking off 2007. And now we're kicking off with a special segment of Amandla, which is CKUT's alternative African views and programming show. We're usually aired Wednesday nights between 7 and 8, but we've come in this morning to take a little bit of a peek at some of the main stories that came off the continent in the year 2006. We'll be covering a couple of major victories and also revisiting some of the stories that kept grabbing our attention again and again over 2006.
Well, the first thing I think we're going to go into today is, hold on, I don't have my script here.
Okay, well, the things that we're going to be talking about is there was a major victory around the Justice for Thomas Sankara campaign at the level of the UN, and we'll be talking to Aziz Fall, the coordinator of that campaign, a little bit later in the hour. Doug has visited over and over again the issue of China and China's growing links with Africa, and so that's something that we'll be discussing this morning as well. We'll also be talking about resources. It always comes back to resources, and we'll be discussing diamonds and in particular how they tie into the Ghana Ngui San of Botswana and their recent land claims victory. So, Doug?
There we go. China. China, of course, has become a major world force, much to the surprise of many people in the United States who never really realized that everything they use is coming from China and never connected the fact that their country is hugely in debt to that country now. In November, that was the perfect example. A huge mega summit. It was called the Africa-China Cooperation Summit occurred. 48 of Africa's 54 leaders were present. Even the countries that do not officially recognize the People's Republic of China, they opted to recognize Taiwan, usually because they were well-bribed, well-lubricated by lucrative aid deals. But even those countries were invited and sent delegations if they didn't send their head of state. Those people, 48 African leaders, represent a quarter of the votes in the United Nations General Assembly, and their presence in China represents a very significant shift in the balance of world power. In 5 years, China will be Africa's biggest trading partner, overtaking France and U.S. combined. China will soon be Africa's biggest lender. Already in 2006, it was at U.S. $8 to $10 billion in loans. And as far as everyone can tell, there are far fewer strings to its involvement. For instance, they don't have all of those nasty structural adjustment program conditions that they put on it. This has made, of course, China very popular with the what we call the polecat states, the Sudans and the Zimbabwes. They're quite happy to have this alternative source of finance. They're quite happy to be able to deal with somebody who's not going to put them under the same kind of pressure that America, Britain, and the West have put them under. The mega conference attracted very little attention in the North American media. However, the one exception was where I could find it in the right-wing press of the States, where the issue was not very much focused on Africa and Africa's African leaders in their hope to escape from the straitjacket of the American imposed structural adjustment programs, but rather the issue was how China was a growing influence in the world, and it was now a potential as a rival superpower. And of course, the jump to that, from that to the conclusion that we need to have our Star Wars and keep our nuclear armaments up. It's an interesting development, China's role in Africa. Very controversial. There's nothing straightforward here. There are no angels. Nobody's wonderful in this one. China, of course, has never been a colonizer of Africa, has never invaded or killed Africans in the way that the European colonialists have. On the other hand, their interests are their own, and their interests are very much tied to their economic growth and their ability to sustain their economy. Their interests are in Africa's resources and taking them out at the cheapest price they can. So some things look very familiar. On the other hand, China now could offer a real interesting alternative to Africa from the oppression of the West. Let's be very clear how Africa has very much been dominated and driven down by Western powers.
Yes, although as the debate certainly rages at Amandla, it's a story that we're going to continue to cover over the course of 2007. And I guess the greatest concerns are, from the African perspective, are do African countries have the leverage and the kind of power to play two powers off of each other for a sweeter deal for themselves? And what does that sweet deal actually represent for the people on the ground? And the concern here is that what this really is going to do is just speed up the pace of emptying Africa of its resources to little or no benefit to the people on the ground, to say nothing of the environment. So it's something that we're watching closely. Our own Moussa Traoré here at Amandla has also, Fode Moussa, sorry, has also followed the story quite closely and in great detail. And I know he will continue to do so. So we urge you to tune in on Wednesday nights at 7 to kind of follow this evolving story.
Now, a lot of what's going on with China, as I said earlier, is that it's out there for African oil, like everybody else's. Oil is of course becoming a fast depleted resource that everybody wants. North America and the United States in particular, as everyone knows, use huge amounts, way out of proportion to their footprint on the their presence on the planet. So what we have now is China growing as it is, and it desperate for oil. And we shouldn't leave China alone here. Now let's remember, India is an economy that's growing at a huge rate. Indonesia, Malaysia, the economies of Southeast Asia generally are growing and voracious appetites for oil and all other resources. And with this now we have the U.S. having the military might to impose its will, and to already the Gulf of Guinea, that part that looks like the big bay on the west side of Africa, accounts for something like 25% of American oil imports. And you can be sure, given what they've done in the Middle East, Iraq and Iran and so on, they're not going to let that be challenged, that dominance be challenged, or that supply be threatened in any way by China or anyone else. They've always been in competition with the Europeans, but now we have a whole new set of actors on the scene. And while some of this could be very good for Africa because it offers them options and offers them a chance to develop, and some of the projects that China's putting in are infrastructure that nobody else would touch because they could get away without having to do it. But now we'll see if this actually leads to a little better return on investment for the Africans and their oil exports.
Well, we will see. And it's good that you brought up oil, Doug, because this is a debate we've had before. If we look back at Talisman, Canada's own Talisman oil company, and the absolutely disastrous record it had in Sudan and bolstering up the Sudanese government in a civil war with the South, there was a broad international and popular movement to get Talisman out of Sudan, and certainly widely supported by Sudanese on the ground in the oil producing regions. And when Talisman was finally forced out of Sudan, who stepped in?
Oh yes, China, India, Malaysia, they were all there with their state-owned companies. So it was getting very, there's no question that this is not, as I say, there are no angels present here. Everybody's got a self-interest. And, of course, the way Africa has been structured, both economically, politically, the way even the neocolonial mentality has kept Africa so dependent on its European history and background and masters, for that matter, it's going to be interesting to see how they use this and whether they do use it at all, because they're so used to giving the resources away for nothing that it'll be interesting to see if we can get some leverage from the presence of new actors on the scene to actually bring more benefit back home. Anyway, let's take a short musical break and we'll be back with more. Thank you. music of the late Ali Farkaturi from Mali. Again, you can see that beautiful rhythm background that is so common in some of the blues themes from the southern U.S., that old guitar blues.
That's beautiful.
Going into resources, oil isn't the only resource Africa's famous for. There's tons of others, but one of the most controversial, of course, has been diamonds recently, and there's been a strong connection with Botswana and the sand people. Gwen, what was that all about?
Well, I'd just like to remind our listeners that you're listening to La Rage du Peuple, and this is the small Amandla segment in this day-long programming, the Year in Review. So back to Botswana. Well, I guess the reason we're bringing you this story is it's actually a really significant victory, and one of the things that we try to do on Amandla is to shift away from headlines that focus so much on doom, gloom, and victimization, and look at the struggles on the ground and the kinds of battles that are being waged, not all of which are necessarily being won, but when there is a victory and there is something important and positive coming out of the continent, we really try to take a closer look at it. This is a bittersweet victory. What we're looking at here was that just a couple of weeks ago, the Gana Nguisan of Botswana won the right to return to their ancestral hunting grounds in the Central Kalahari Game Reserve. The Botswana High Court ruled that the 1,000 or so San had the right to return to the area 4 years after they were forcibly removed by the Botswana government. Now, what happened 4 years ago was that the government decided that they wanted to move these folks off the land, and they did so by denying the San hunting licenses, by cutting off their water holes, closing down the minimal government services that were there, like the couple of clinics, and basically trying to make it impossible for the remaining San who are living in this area to continue to do so. But there are also reports that there were forced removals and that trucks drove in late at night and collected families and put them on these trucks and then drove them out. And these people were resettled in sort of remote settlement camps. Now, why? What was going on here? Well, one of the issues around this is paternalism and the long-standing racism and prejudice against the San. The San are part of a 70,000-year-old hunting and gathering culture, and the majority Setswana of Botswana view them as backward and uncivilized, and that this move to gather them in villages and tie them into a cash economy was part of development and the development project. And in fact, the president of Botswana is on record as saying that they're Stone Age creatures in the age of computers, and this is considered very much an affront to a lot of the Setswana, and that settling them in the villages would be good for them and bring them development, when in fact what's happened is that it's brought terrible poverty, death, problems with AIDS and alcoholism. But the next layer, and possibly the one that more importantly informed this whole decision, was diamonds. Botswana has been referred to as one huge company town owned by the diamond giant De Beers, and diamonds are really what make this country tick. The first steps to try to remove the sand were actually back in 86 with the discovery of kimberlite, which is the rock that contains diamonds. And in fact, only just a couple of months ago, a couple of drilling companies started diamond exploration in the game reserve. So what does this all mean? Well, the fact that the diamond development is going on in the area certainly would indicate that this conflict is not over. It's also going to be quite the challenge for the San, given that only 5% of the wildlife remains in the reserve compared to about 30 years ago. And this is largely due to the fact that the government put up cattle fencing around the park, which has interrupted the migratory patterns of the wildlife. This ruling, the court ruling, also does not compel the government to provide state services in this area. So no clinics, no schools, and really, ultimately, most importantly, they're not required to reopen those water holes that they sealed off 4 years ago to force the people out. Then there's, again, as I said, the diamond factor and the fact that huge swaths of the park have been leased to two diamond companies. So we're going to have to wait and see how that all plays itself out. But I don't want to end on a negative note. There's also, this is a significant ruling and it's a precedent in Botswana. It's probably going to open up a lot of other land claims in the courts. And what it does is that it reverses over two decades of government policy to remove the San from the reserve. They're clearly victorious in having their right recognized to this land and to practice hunting and gathering. It validates a culture that's been discriminated against for decades. And in the words of one of the San spokespersons, Roy Sasana, the San are happy with their land and they don't necessarily want government services. And he very rightly points out that it's the government services that were used to force the San off their land. And his attitude is forget the clinics and forget the schools. Let us back onto the land and we will be a far healthier population. So that's pretty much where the situation stands now. It's one that is clearly not over, but it's an important step possibly towards resolution.
What's amazing is, of course, the whole thing is driven by greed and not wanting to share at all. The San are people who have had traditional rights to that land for eons. We can't even count it in centuries. And ironically, long ago under British colonial rule, it was created as a nature reserve to keep it. It's a very sensitive area, very, very delicate balance of nature there. It's an inland drainage area where the rivers come into the Kalahari, and because they flow there, it's a very fertile area, very rich, and especially when the rains come, it just becomes blossoms, and then it dries up. It has no exit, so it's an inland sea essentially, and the San have profited from this and benefited and lived it for centuries. Now they were being taken off because they were threatening the environment. This is the government's
this is the right, argument, yeah.
Only to let De Beers come in and, of course, not threaten it with their diamond mining. So this is really quite interesting because it links back to some of the very things that are happening here. We've heard so much about Canada becoming a diamond now power and how our diamonds are nice and clean. They're not like the blood diamonds out of Sierra Leone, Liberia. And yet what have we got coming out of the Anishinaabe Aski Nation, right? Right now is they represent some 49 First Nations people living in the far north of Canada, and they, like the Bushmen, have appealed to Leonardo DiCaprio because of his film. They've appealed to him to help them publicize their issues, and their issues, of course, are right back to land claims. Who owns all of this? How come the Canadian government can give out mining rights and concessions and allow mining to go on, and who's that all going to, when in fact who owns the land is the first claim that has to be settled. In addition, right back to the delicate balance of the land, much of this northern arboreal forest is undisturbed forest ecosystems. As I say, in the case of Namibia, very delicate. In the case of Botswana, very delicate. And in the case of the north, very delicate. That's an ecosystem that's very fragile. And here we are now sending in huge equipment and digging large holes and upsetting the whole balance. So ironically, it's come right back home, the fact that we have the fact that we have the land claim now being won in Botswana, and it's a wonderful win. Yes, there are lots of holes in it, and we have to always be aware of it. But the San people have struggled long and hard for this. Roy Sasana has been a marvelous leader, and you should hear him talk.
Yeah, he's
just a beautiful speaker, and his speeches, when they're translated, obviously from the San, are just pearls of wisdom. They're just amazing. So he's done an amazing job. They've done an amazing job and deserve all the full credit for it. I think what we should do maybe is take another brief musical pause here and see if we can get Aziz on the phone for one other victory we want to brag about this year.
Enfants qu'on amène au service militaire pour aller faire la guerre, qui ne connaissent pas la cause pourquoi ils partent mourir. Yeah. Sabab sa de makabu kadom fafa alere kando duwa nafa.
Welcome back to the Amandla segment of La Rage du Peuple, and I believe that we now have Aziz Fall on the line. He's the coordinator of the Justice for Thomas Sankara campaign. Aziz, can you hear me?
Yes, good morning.
Okay, good. Thanks for joining us. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to all of you.
Just to bring our listeners into the picture here a little bit, because not everybody here necessarily listens to Amandla every Wednesday night. There has been a campaign that's been up and running for a number of years now, the Justice for Sankara campaign. Thomas Sankara was the president of Burkina Faso, was assassinated in 1987, and the reason he continues to be so important to so many of us around the world was that he was very committed to dismantling the colonial and neo-colonial structures in Burkina Faso, a small country in West Africa, and very steadfastly in the short time that he was in power worked, as I said, to dismantle those economic and political structures, and also to begin to reconstruct people's identities, in particular in terms of gender relations and the roles of men and women in Burkina Faso. And for this legacy, he continues to be a very mobilizing force both in Africa and around the world. He was a committed Pan-Africanist. And when he was assassinated, it was obviously very, very shocking, but it was also a very, very damaging, to revolutionary forces in on the continent of Africa, and as a result, people mobilized to try to bring his killers to justice. The official story out of Burkina Faso was that he died of natural causes, which was widely known and understood to be untrue, and it's widely known and understood that the current president of Burkina Faso, Blaise Compaoré, was behind the assassination. So that just gives a very thumbnail sketch. Aziz, as coordinator of this campaign, there were some extremely important developments in 2006. So I was wondering if in about 2 minutes you could just give us an overview of that.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, the UN committee considered that the refusal to conduct an investigation into the death of Thomas Sankara and the lack of the official recognition of his place of burial and also the failure to correct the death certificate constitute a inhuman treatment of Ms. Sankara and her son in breach of Article 7 and 14 of the Covenant. And so the Burkina Faso was given 3 months to comply. Unfortunately, they did nothing really well. I mean, they did actually create a new death certificate just saying that he died, not mentioning how he died. And they give little money as a way of compensating, and they said they're going to build some type of a statue. We have no proof whatsoever that that's exactly where he is buried, and we are asking the UN committee to enforce the remedies with the immediate commencement of an impartial judicial inquiry in Burkina Faso to duly establish the circumstances of Thomas Sankara's death, and that's just to fulfill the state party outstanding obligation to remedy until on the ongoing Article 7 breaches under the Covenant. And we want also to make sure that the family would be compensated. As you said, this year in 2007 will be the 20th anniversary of his death, and this is a major event. We have to remind the people that was the last revolution in Africa. It was the last one. It was halted brutally as a way of making sure that it would never be repeated on the ground of the African continent. And despite of that, I think people are still interested to know exactly what happened, and they don't want to be discouraged.
Just to clarify, the UN Human Rights Committee that agreed to hear this case, was one of their decisions that there be an impartial inquiry on the ground, or is that a demand of the exclusively a demand of the campaign?
They did actually ask to have what we call the Minister of Defense commence a judicial inquiry to establish the circumstances of Thomas Sankara's death, which is obviously to start some form of inquiry. You have to comply with what exists in within that country, and you have to understand also that the UN committee can't really judge the issue, but have to say that, well, the judicial system was partial or was not partial. So it's just remedies to provide in case of intentional violation of the articles that the country ratified.
And why would it be the Minister of Defense instead of the Minister of Justice?
Because since he was a military, he was the one who would actually give the orders to the Ministry of Justice to start the inquiry. But the whole judicial system is paralyzed. The Procureur du Faso, Adama Sagno, is the one actually who refused to say, well, this is normally something that I have received from the Minister of Defense. So the whole system is totally paralyzed. And just recently, an ordonnance de non-lieu was given to the Norbert Zongo case, which is another unlawful death of a journalist killed with three other people, showing that the whole system is just totally paralyzed. And just for the sake of your information, last week, police and the army fought along, you know, defending the regime last week just in Burkina Faso. So I think the whole system is totally paralyzed, and we look forward to see how things are going to be developing in 2007.
Well, that's so. The ball is in whose court at this point? If you're saying that the system is
UN, because the UN have to judge what the country has done, if it's enough or not. We did send our communication, what we call reply comments, on the order, and now we're waiting in April to the final decision of the UN, whether or not they would be satisfied with what the country has done.
Okay, so last question. In theory, what can the UN do if they are in agreement with you that the justice system is compromised inside the country? What at that point can the committee do?
They normally use the special rapporteur on follow-up to conduct an independent fact-finding mission in Burkina Faso and submit both Burkina Faso comments to follow-up, and then they publish on the Human Rights Committee annual report to the UN General Assembly via the UN General Secretary General to ensure compliance on the part of Burkina Faso. That's the judicial side, but it has a tremendous effect, because then it means that no other country should cooperate with that country. So you could now exert some type of lobby with foreign aids and bilateral aids, etc., to show that this is an unlawful regime. It's not respecting democracy. It's not respecting human rights, etc.
For people who want to learn more about the campaign, how can they reach you?
So on our website, we have contact. It's admin@grilla.org, or just go on our website or call 514-499-3418.
Thanks for joining us, Aziz.
My pleasure. Thank you. And Happy New Year again.
You too. And that was Aziz Fall, coordinator of the Justice for Sankara campaign. And I think that pretty much wraps it up for the Amandla segment of La Rage du Peuple.
Not yet. Oh. I want to ask you guys something.
Oh. Go for it.
I mean, it is New Year's Day, and it was really really interesting listening to you recapping the past year. I'm just wondering if you can look ahead a bit. What are the issues you'll be following besides the ones you talked about? What's going to make you rage in 2007?
Don't get him started. On Wednesday, just to tell you, Amandla plays every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock here at CKUT 90.3. We will be doing this coming Wednesday our own New Year's wrap-up.
So
we'll be trying to be more comprehensive over the whole hour that we have ahead of us there. But Somali, of course, is a big issue to watch out for. The United States has got its proxy Ethiopia to walk in there, and they've done it apparently very smoothly. But that's what happened when the United States walked into Baghdad, and look at where we are today there. So I think we're going to watch that one very, very closely, try to follow the geopolitics of it and see what's behind all of that. Oil resources, clearly very, very big. Lots to watch out there.
Yeah.
China and all those other countries that are moving in, as we said earlier, are already a large, large factor in changing the balance of power in Africa.
Yeah. And not just China. The story will definitely continue to follow is Canadian mining involvement in Africa. It is absolutely huge, and Canadian complicity in the crimes surrounding mining is big story. And so we'll continue to try to unearth some of the information around that. Also, that a DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the fact that there were elections and that Kabila won does not put this conflict to bed for 1 minute. So we're certainly going to continue to take a look at what's going on there and the ongoing pillaging of resources in that area.
North to south, Africa is such a huge continent, so key to what happens in the world and so badly treated by everybody.
All right. Well, I want to personally thank you guys for coming in. You were the earliest guests to come in on New Year's Day. I kind of tricked you to come in and with the freezing rain and everything, but it's great, and thanks a lot.
Well,
and encourage our listeners to stay tuned for more Raj de la Peuple today, and to stay tuned to Amanla as it comes up during the year.
Happy New Year to everyone.
New Year to you.